I'm J.G. Michael, and this is Parallax Views.
Parallax is you observe an object, you see a change, but that change is not really a change in the object, but just a change in how you relate to the object in your perspective of the object.
Welcome to the testing room of the Parallax Corporation's Division of Human Engineering.
Now please cross the chair. And you will sit down. Make yourself comfortable. And be sure to place each one of your hands on the box on either side of the chair. Making sure that each one of your fingers is on one of the white rectangles. Just sit back. Nothing is required of you except to observe the materials that are presented to you. Be sure to keep your fingers on the box at all times. Alright? Hope you find the test a pleasant experience.
On this edition of Parallax Views, I'll be speaking with Michael Brooks, co-host of the Majority Report and host of the Michael Brooks Show. Majority Report and the Michael Brooks Show are two of the premier podcasts covering politics and current events from a left-wing perspective. In our discussion, Michael and I cover how he became involved in leftist politics, the importance of comedy and humor in getting out leftist messages, his bang-up impersonations of Barack Obama, combating the intellectual dark web, or as I call it, the intellectual dork web, the ideas of Marxist sociologist Zygmunt Bauman in comparison to the reactionary YouTube philosophy star Jordan Peterson. Ugh, I don't think we'll ever stop hearing about that guy. And a little bit of talk near the end of our episode about his not being a fan of rapper Immortal Technique. Have a little bit of beef over that with Michael, but you'll hear it in the episode. All that and more on this edition of Parallax Views. I hope you enjoy my conversation with Michael Brooks. Welcome to Parallax Views, Michael Brooks.
Hey, it's great to be here, Michael.
So let's start with, how did you become involved in leftist politics?
That's interesting. I guess to some extent, I've been involved in leftist politics most of my life. In the sense that my parents were kind of late hippies, basically. My dad, not particularly political, kind of more on the sort of alternative kind of health, sort of counterculture, very, very skeptical of institutions across the board, in fact. And my mother, though, was more you know, in line with, she did solidarity activism around issues like, you know, movements in Latin America, supported the Sandinistas, protested, you know, apartheid South Africa, and definitely had a certain sort of socialist politics, democratic socialist politics. And also, you know, both of them were very much of the mind. You know, when I was born, they had me when they were extremely young and, you know, no money in the bank, living out of a car kind of a thing. And they definitely, you know, they thought that probably, you know, the system was headed to some type of ecological or social collapse and that, you know, you didn't want to put your kid in institutions like school. It's a certain type of left, actually, that I hate in some ways because of some parenting decisions that I would have done differently, frankly. But in other ways, I kind of miss, there was a certain creativity to it. It's not my politics, but there was a lot of writers, like as an example, the anarchist Catholic Ivan Illich, who wrote Deschooling Society, is actually pretty brilliant. Has a lot of insights about industrialization and bureaucratic institutions, both public and private, and how they affect people. So that was sort of the base. And then in middle school, I was a sort of, or middle school age, because I was unschooled or homeschooled, I was a sort of hybrid of a kind of precocious political reader and juvenile delinquent. So I'd go and, you know, and shoplift and smoke weed. And then, you know, I was very fascinated by civil rights and just the 60s. And I read books, you know, I read Soul on Ice by Eldridge Cleaver, an autobiography of Malcolm X, and lots of other books on that milieu. And that definitely, I think, you know, amplified and set my politics. And it's been through several iterations ever since, including, you know, probably a healthy lurch probably in like later high school and through college, where I never was on the political right, but I was kind of, you know, fed up by being around a bunch of like, you know, loser hippie leftists, and I wanted to figure out how to win. So I read a lot of books about the Third Way and, you know, and Obama and Tony Blair and Bill Clinton. But it wasn't just that my politics, and in fact, they never really moved that much. But I did want to look at a kind of broader base for how coalitions were formed, how politics is marketed. And so on. And then the other kind of touch point in college is I took a class where I had to, it was a class on Capital, just reading Capital. And I think from that point onwards, I was to some extent, at the very least, an analytical Marxist, if that makes sense. I wasn't really in, you know, I'd never have been a formal part of Marxist politics. I had no interest, you know, at the same time, especially, you know, then I wasn't, you know, I had no interest in sort of, you know, getting involved. I mean, I have more respect for it now than I did then, but I wasn't going to join some Trotskyite cell or anything. I wasn't interested in revisionist histories to try to like sweep up the crimes of the Soviet Union or Mao or any of that, which I also read about widely and was fascinated by. But it just stuck with me. I mean, I think it's just very basics in perspective. Like, wages hide the real relationship between labor and capital, and that's what profit is. Profit is essentially like, you know, this is, you know, kind of sloppy, but profit is stolen labor time. It just resonated. It was like, yes, this describes the world pretty well. You know, I ended up doing a bunch of different things in my 20s, but ended up working, you know, in politics and media, and, you know, have always been on the left inside of that world.
Yeah. It's interesting that you mentioned, sort of being influenced by that, like, hippie thought and then moving on to like more serious leftism. I was sort of the same way when I was like a teenager. I got real into like, the yippies, like Abby Hoffman,
yeah.
Paul Krasner. And it's interesting because I sort of see hints of that on your podcast, because there's a lot of like pranksterish humor. And I think that's real important for the left to have at times.
Yeah. I mean, I think there's so many different traditions that you can point to. And I am aware, you know, I've read about and I appreciate Abby Hoffman and I appreciate the Situationists to some extent. There's also just that I really grew up liking good comedy, you know, across the board. I mean, everything from, you know, the real, you know, the giants, Richard Pryor, George Carlin, but also, you know, Howard Stern, and definitely I mean, man, when I was like 19 or whatever, I mean, the Chappelle Show was a big deal. I mean, that was a fucking amazing show. And you know, and also, you know, Bill Hicks, certainly, he didn't influence me as much as other people, but he was definitely in the mix to some extent. And today, you know, and Bill Burr and Chris Rock and Louis C.K. and you know, just a lot of very astute, very insightful comedians. And I think that it influences the show. I mean, both just because I think I like comedy and I think it's, you know, it's fun. And I think there is that kind of subversive history to it. I think it's also good. I mean, I really don't like the brand of the left to be sort of like, you know, neurotic and tense. I think that we should be the ones, you know, kind of having fun, sort of like fighting, you know, the beautiful struggle or whatever, you know, poetic way we want to put it. That stuff definitely lives in me. And I think things like, you know, I even think like Abbie Hoffman posing as like a fake restaurant critic when he was on the run in Europe. I think that's hilarious. And I think more people should learn from it.
Yeah, I really like this trend on certain segments of the left, for instance, with your show and also with Chapo Trap House, to sort of like be humorous, to make fun of like the enemy, the Jordan Petersons and alt weenies of the world, you know?
Definitely. I mean, I think it's so crucial because, I mean, you know, it's also just this very, there's this certain neurotic mindset, which, by the way, totally cuts across political identification. There's this kind of major effort to make it like, you know, a symptom of the left and this whole like boring PC discourse that goes on. But the truth of the matter is that there is a tendency right now of a lot of people who are in positions of influence across the political spectrum to be very, very melodramatic, very precious, and very controlling. I mean, ironically, you know, I see it actually so clearly in the Jordan Petersons and Sam Harris's of the world. This just utter neurosis and control freakery and delusions of grandeur. And I think it's, you know, I genuinely think what's, you know, when I do a show where I can do like a half hour with a, like, you know, an amazing reporter, like say like Mike Hanna, right, and do a deep dive on Zimbabwe and South Africa, the political economy, the history of the ANC, whatever, and then, you know, just do some like vicious bit, or just even enjoy, you know, an Alex Jones clip, right? Like Alex Jones is terrible. I mean, he's a toxic force in the society, but I also think like we also really enjoy him, and it's okay. Like we can have the confidence to acknowledge that and sort of realize, you know, that just the sort of like utter muck we're in, and realize that like, you know, having manners and moral condemnation is not going to get us out of it. It's going to be actual work. And part of the emotional stamina that at least I need for the actual work is to actually like laugh a lot and enjoy my life. You know, I want everybody else to as well, as much as possible.
Yeah. And I think having a sense of humor about these things is what will allow the left to win people over. You know, I was talking to someone recently about Joe Rogan and his sort of slide to the right recently. And I feel like people like yourself, if you were to talk to Rogan, or if the people at Chapo were to talk to Rogan, maybe we could like win him over just a little bit.
Oh no, I think there's so much to be said for basically, I mean, that this is actually the funny, you know, I have some background and I did a little bit of work like in the more like the branding space and the kind of some connections like the advertising world. And, you know, I think that there is an allergy, particularly among certain people on the left, and I get it structurally, you know, structurally, you know, why you would have a critique of the advertising industry or propaganda or whatever, right? I mean, that's pretty obvious. But I do think that what some people miss is that, yes, I mean, so much of public kind of, you know, winning people over is just establishing either like a real rapport with them, which is, you know, unfortunately, obviously what some of these alt-right people are doing and appealing to very toxic sentiments, or just honestly just having, you know, an entertainment value to it, a charisma to it. And I, you know, it's not like some overwhelming amount of people by any stretch of the imagination. And obviously my following and platform is, you know, is a fraction of, you know, Peterson or Harris or whatever, but I have also gotten a few of those like, hey man, I'm so glad I found your stuff. I think if I didn't, I would be harassing people about lobsters. And it all comes down to, it's attitudinal and dispositional. And somehow, you know, there was definitely, I mean, you know, it's overblown by our political enemies, but it's also true enough that there was, you know, that the left really started getting associated with like, yeah, okay, yeah, that's problematic, you know. And it's just, I mean, in addition to being unfun and often not real political analysis, that kind of, that sort of posture is just, it's just a brand killer, if you indulge me in my advertising speak.
Right, right. Well, but before we move on from the whole comedy topic and the sense of humor your show has, is there any way I can get you to do a Nation of Islam Obama impersonation? Because I've always loved that on the show.
You know, you got to, you know what it is, you got to somehow, I'll try to think. Oh, so today, I was hosting Majority Report today, and today we played a clip of Trump, and he's just, I mean, it's just, it's so, I mean, I can't believe I still laugh at this shit, but he's literally on the tarmac, and it's so funny because he's like getting, he's clearly starting to get bored with bragging about how well the economy is supposedly doing, probably because it isn't like specific enough to him as a person. And he's just, and he's on his way. He's literally flying, I think, to Texas to meet, or, you know, with students or people who have just gone through a school shooting. Right. So he goes, he's just like, you know, it's, the economy's great, never been better. And now we're going to go to Texas and we're gonna have some fun, which is just a fucking amazing way of previewing a trip. Victims of mass murder in a school. We're gonna have some fun. So, you know, that was an irresistible, like, you know, a lot more devils are employed. The economy's moving fast, and we're gonna go to Newtown or eat some ice cream. We're gonna have some good time down there. The place has a much more vital downtown than I had expected. So, maybe do some book shopping and comfort some Yakubs that got shot or whatever. All right, thanks. Thanks, everybody.
Bravo.
Yeah, that's a lot of fun, man. I've always wondered what Obama would think of that impression.
One can only imagine what he'd think if he heard it.
Because a part of me, I mean, I'm totally of the school of, you know, strong political critique, but you know, totally like the guy. You know, I don't understand what, like, what's not to like on a sort of personality level. And a part of me thinks that, you know, I don't know, maybe 70% of Paul, but 30% of him would be like, oh, it's pretty good. Not bad.
Yeah, Obama's an interesting character because, like, you kind of can't help but like him. And he's sort of, I think in a lot of ways, and this, people will say I'm being a liberal for this. See, Derek Varn will get angry. But I think Obama meant well and thought he could really reform the system, you know?
Oh, I think so. And I think that it's, you know, Obama is an area where maybe it's just the sort of, I actually think there's actually something important about how we talk about Obama that actually reflects on where we fit politically. So I definitely and I won't make an overclaim for myself. I'm probably something of a democratic socialist. Although I will say, and I have been, you know, more and more open about this, I think that the amount of wealth and sort of market concentration that we're going to need to break up to have a democratized society looks is very aggressive and broadly expansive in my mind, probably beyond what a lot of other people in my cohort would say when they say democratic socialist. So I'm not a, you know, gay space communism guy. I'm not opposed to electoral politics. I'm not opposed to lesser of two evil voting, all of this type of stuff. But at the same time, I'm, you know, my conception of what needs to be taken out of private hands is not, you know, I don't just mean like we need single payer and, you know, some other really good, robust social services. I'm talking about something much more aggressive and expansive than that. So, you know, my politics are, at the very least, firmly in a sort of actual left position with real structural critique of capitalism. But I do think, you know, there's some people, and, you know, it runs the spectrum from a smart C. Derek Varn take to a, and forgive me, like a dumb Jimmy Dore take.
I thought you were going to mention him.
Yeah. I mean, look, liberals are not the biggest enemy. You know, especially not now. And I think that they are sometimes they're absolutely our enemy. Other times they're opponents. And other times, in terms of reality, they are, like it or not, something more akin to coalition partners. And I find so much of the discourse about Obama so frustrating, because obviously there's a contingent of people who, you know, they idolize the man. They don't want any structural conversation about you know, his policy record. And by the way, even his policy record, if we totally took the most benign, you know, Obama's a great guy and he tried to do blah, 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 blah. If you have any kind of left politics, you still have to deal with, you know, Wall Street, housing crisis, drones, increased inequality, letting Silicon Valley set the rules for itself, generating an entirely new, you know, hyper predatory inequality, increasing economy. All of this stuff, right? We know all of this. Anybody who knows what they're talking about knows this, of course. But there is this other tendency of, and again, I'll use the word neurotic. You know, anytime there's a new Trump atrocity, well, Obama did that. I think it's both, it makes people look foolish to some extent because, you know, still, in most of these cases, the Obama record is not as bad as the Trump record, and most normal people just sort of know that. And also, it robs from the deeper critique that we're trying to make, which is like, look, if all you're concerned about is Trump, then you don't have a diagnosis to get us out of our predicament. And at the end of the day, you're going to contribute to the problem because of course, I buy the argument in some respects that, you know, the precursor to Trump is something like a global third way that Obama was a part of. But at the same time, if we can't acknowledge what is better and preferable on a relative scale, that to me starts to smack of a kind of performative purity politics, which I'm utterly allergic to and I'll always be. And I think, you know, there's the conversations we need to have about Obama that are about the record and being clear about it and not having a fantasy and a, you know, restore, you know, sort of like, oh my God, if only Obama was back. That's garbage that needs to be confronted. But kind of this incessant equivalency and trying to get people to not like Obama in a way that some of us might is substantively wrong. And I think just a misuse of energy for building a broad coalition.
Right, right. I would totally agree with that. I wanted to back up real quick since we inevitably got on the topic of Jordan Peterson and this whole, everyone calls it the intellectual dark web. I call it the intellectual dork web.
Right.
But, you know, it's interesting. I like what you've said about it, that when it comes to these characters like Peterson, Weinstein, Charles Murray, we really have to sort of like follow the money trail and see where they're getting their funding from, what think tanks they're working for. I mean, Alex Jones is being funded by Sinclair Broadcasting. Eric Weinstein is, he works for Peter Thiel. You know, and I feel like a lot of leftists haven't looked at that. They're only grappling with the ideas and not looking at the money trail.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because I actually, you know, sometimes, you know, I've had a, you know, a couple conversations like this with Doug Lane, and he's actually convinced me to get a little bit more sort of serious about taking these things on an ideational, on an ideal level. But I agree with you. I just think, you know, fundamentally, the trouble with most right-wing politics is that it's either like sort of cult thinking, like libertarianism, which would not have much currency, I think, in the normal world if it didn't have unending sort of funding behind it. And I think that, you know, I basically think if we looked at right-wing politics on that level, there is actually – I think the liberal critique of it sort of stands to some to a large extent. I think there's no normal people in the world, or very few normal people in the world, that care about you know, slashing taxes for the Koch brothers and economic fantasies, right? They don't care. There's a lot of normal people in the world that absolutely are motivated by, I would say, we should say, white identity politics and racism. That's a real force. And I think that that is the way we could the best way to understand right-wing politics really is that synthesis, and that there's always going to be, you know, handsome funding for anybody that comes down the pike with these ideas. Now, I don't know about, you know, Jordan Peterson. I think Jordan Peterson has struck, and I think some of these people do, you know, strike real popular chords. And I think always when they strike a popular chord, it's interesting. The closest it gets to economic policy is some type of version of self-help, actually, which is not, it's less a argument about how the economy should work and more a pep talk about how you can manage your own economy in what is a, you know, terrifying, precarious, and totally unequal world. And it's not irrational for people to try to figure out how to position themselves inside it. And I actually think that the left, I don't know if we need a story for that, because obviously ultimately we're working on, you know, sort of actual power solutions and actual policies to get us out of that predicament. But I also think that, you know, when we scoff at certain types of appeal to that more self-help world, we're, you know, we're negating what is actually in some ways a very rational response to the terrifying conditions we're in. I think, yeah, someone like Charles Murray is purely a product of, you know, right-wing largesse and think tankery. It's an incredibly easy world. And the extent to which he has a real popular imprint in the public imagination is because he's a promoter of, you know, racism with footnotes. And that's a very, very potent brand. And so I think you're right. I think there's somewhere in between, there's sort of three responses that I see to these people. And one is sort of like indignation and dismissal, which I want people to be clear. I actually understand it. I get it. I've seen these videos and seen these people, and I've gotten disgusted. And I actually understand that upset. But it doesn't work very effectively. Then there's, you know, let's take them at their ideas and deal with them and take them at face value. And I think that there's some real value in at least showing people that we can actually do that. Although I think there starts to be a real limited utility in it, because almost always, I mean, I don't know, man, like someone like Thaddeus Russell, right? Like he seems like, okay, you can have a sort of, I haven't talked to him. I don't know Thaddeus, but it seems from everything I've heard, there's someone I have profound disagreements with, but you can have a sort of, you know, genuine joust or inquiry with him, and he'll, you know, and he'll concede and he'll reflect and you'll concede and you'll reflect and so on and so forth. That is completely not the case with 99.999% of these people. And they're brands. They're selling a lifestyle brand, not an actual argument. So at some point, you're always going to run up into the limit of where their ideals will go and you know, what will actually happen in that exchange. And I think the third part, yeah, I think it is starting to look at things like, well, who actually funds these people? What's the and to the extent they have a broad appeal, what is the sociological truth or the political moment, or frankly, for being real, I think in some ways in Peterson's case, the sexual moment, you know, behind what's going on.
Right, right. Well, the other thing I wanted to add is that even with someone like Peterson, like let's assume Peterson is somehow getting money from like a Robert Mercer or Peter Thiel, that at the same time doesn't discredit the ideas on their own. And you do have to take the ideas and take them in good faith on some level, you know?
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's where, you know, as I said, I think Doug has convinced me. And I think there's value to it. Although I would still maintain that if you really wanted to understand, just even as an example, you know, even I think Murray in some ways is a great example of this, because, you know, if you really looked at it, you know, the engine of his work is not even, it's not racism. The engine of his work is reification and naturalization of all forms of class and structural hierarchy, a lot of which obviously the United States overlap with race, but, you know, that's why he wrote the Falling Behind book and then made the cultural argument with regards to white people. And so, you know, you ask yourself, well, why is it a guy who is obsessed with finding explanations and justifications, no matter how shaky and spurious in their sort of conceptual foundation, but someone who is willing to put in a lot of actual work and write actual books, as, you know, disgusting as their conclusions are, you know, what is his actual project here? What's his foundational aim? And when you understand his foundational aim, it's pretty obvious why America's oligarchs would be very excited to fund this guy. So I think, you know, as a matter of understanding, you know, who they are, that is the most effective. I think, yes, some of them, you know, you should engage with. And then I guess, you know, the fallout is sort of self-explanatory. I mean, you know, Ezra, that was why the Ezra Klein thing with Sam Harris was so effective, because in many ways, you know, Ezra Klein essentially exemplified what Harris claims to be. And then, you know, that was just sort of it. And, you know, and Harris didn't absorb anything. And people who have a sort of cult-like devotion to him said, you know, Ezra isn't interested in science and blah, blah, blah. And they just sort of restated everything Sam said. And that's where I get a little bit wary of this sort of debate lane, because I do think that it is very cult-like. And I don't know how deep that argument can go. But I have been convinced that there's enough people that are sort of observing. So as an example, I had on 2 weeks ago, I had on Eric Turkheimer, who's one of the geneticists who, you know, critiqued Harris on the bell curve. And we had a pretty in-depth and in conversation that in some ways I still have some sort of foundational questions about IQ. But for purposes of that conversation, it means an IQ, you know, he doesn't question the validity of it as a metric, but he, you know, has very different conclusions than Murray. His fascinating research on actually class and genetic versus environmental expression and intelligence. And we had a really great conversation, and somebody pointed me that it was, you know, upvoted in the Sam Harris Reddit thread. And there were definitely some people on it going, hey, this was actually a really good conversation. And, it, you know, and, you know, it was well done, and it speaks poorly of Sam that he wasn't the one who did it. So great. I mean, that definitely was a point towards Doug's view.
Yeah. Yeah. It's weird for me listening to that Harris Klein debate, because it's almost like it's 2 hours of Sam Harris angrily saying, "You're calling me a racist." You
know? Well, I mean, he's just, I mean, I don't know, man. He fits in that classic, I get, that is a very classic right-wing pattern that, you know, it's never the thing itself that's the real problem. It's being called it, right? Like it's never actually like, you know, hey, I mean, you know, maybe, you know, uncritically promoting the bell curve on your show, maybe you could at least entertain why people might have some problems with that. It's like, no, of course. It's just, I was called this thing on Twitter. And you know, I saw this with Sam, because I first started talking about Sam with regards to Islam and foreign policy. And what was funny is that, you know, some people more on my side of things and who would certainly, you know, would not get into like the social Darwinism and, you know, craniology stuff, but they were maybe more sympathetic on the you know, basically using like Quran quotes to explain geopolitics, which when you really sit and think about it is a sort of just disastrously stupid project. But that being said, you know, his big response to that was like, oh, well, when you take my one of these torture or nuke the Middle East thought experiments out of context, I feel like it's actually my job to put Sam Harris into context with all of this nonsense. You know, what you're doing is you're defaming and besmirching me, and it's bad for my public brand to be accused of these things. It was actually almost never an actual argument about foreign policy or about how the Middle East works. And then it would just, and then to the extent it was just, well, you know, here's another disturbing quote from the Hadith and you don't take it seriously. And, you know, and that sort of thing does make one a little bit sour on, you know, how far can we go here? I mean, you know, Jordan Peterson, I mean, my God, it's so much more overt. I mean, essentially subtextually, at least to me, is almost saying, it's like, you know, he's a religious prophet. I mean, you're not, this is not like, hey, guy, like, you know, hey, guy, this sort of desire to sort of naturalize Jungian archetypes into like social Darwinist interpretation of evolution is kind of interesting. But this is not like you're making a lot of sky is blue comments about actually like pre-rational magical thinking and then incredibly contested science. And you know, and then when you call on it, you either prevaricate, shift the goalposts, or go on attack. And, you know, so what are we to do with that?
Right. Yeah, Peterson, I've actually been speaking the last few days with University of Toronto professor, Dr. Bernard Schiff, who just wrote an essay about his experiences. Yeah.
I read. Yeah.
But yeah, there is something like demagogic about Peterson that sort of puts me off. Even though I don't completely disagree with some of his self-help, I just don't know that you can map that onto the political.
I totally agree with you. And again, I actually think that in some respects, you know, that's a sort of, you know, I think Peterson is very effective. And I think even, you know, you see this sometimes with Harris too. Like, so there was that clip that went around with Peterson and the Vice interviewer, and they were talking about makeup in the workplace, right? So let's even get slightly more controversial than some of his self-help advice, which I agree with you is actually, you know, it's totally, from what I could see, a lot of it is totally, it is sensible to eat well. And, you know, I mean, it's funny, you're actually, I don't know, I guess I have some bad habits, but I keep my apartment clean, I exercise, I meditate, I brush my teeth 3-4 times a day, you know, I don't know, I'm living some Peterson shit out. But, you know, he made that comment about, you know, makeup. And of course, you know, what people went to quickly, and rightly so, was these, you know, he made these really insane statements about, you know, potentially, if a woman is wearing makeup, they're you know, they're sort of asking for it in terms of being sexually harassed, which is just, you know, demented and reactionary and misogynist. That's all true. And then this sort of, you know, like, I don't know, maybe we can't work together, you know, this sort of crap. But I think what people missed is that in the beginning part of that exchange, when he said, you know, women wear makeup to appeal, appear more attractive. And the interviewer kind of looked at him like that was one of the dumbest things you could possibly say. I think there is a part of people that's where the disconnect is, because, you know, what the interviewer could have done more accurately is like, well, I don't know, like, aren't you wearing that, you know, blazer to make your shoulders look more filled out? Like, don't human beings of every kind, you know, groom themselves and try to present themselves in various different ways? And, oh, and by the way, you know, here's an example of, a racist comment in a workforce where, you know, a black woman was told to straighten her hair as an example if she wanted to, you know, work in a front office. And isn't this really a whole conversation about expectations of appearance that everybody, but particularly women, have? So, yes, of course, women are, you know, doing things when they go into the workplace to appear more attractive. But there's a whole structure behind it. And that's what he has no answer to. But if you sit there and roll your eye, or he does have answers and they're incredibly, you know, primitive, reactionary and sexist. But if you sit there and roll your eyes when he says something that's basically true, I think that's where there's the opening for those guys, because it looks to a certain viewer who isn't going to the deeper implications like, wait a second, like he just said that you put on lipstick to, you know, make your lips look more full, and the Vice guy's looking at him like he's an idiot. Like, what? Everybody knows that. And I think that's where some of the breakdown happens.
See, my first reaction was, well, don't men wear suits and ties, and don't men bodybuild and stuff? Like, it's...
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Well, no, that's what I was talking about, the blazer and Peterson. There's no... Well, I mean, yeah, of course. There's a million, you know, ways of taking that, to counteract it. I just think that sometimes, you know, like, I actually thought Russell Brand did a great job with Sam Harris in many ways, in terms of trying to get Harris to, you know, for once talk about power and how things actually work in the world. And I, you know, and again, I've done a lot of stuff. I do think that, you know, grand, broad statements about Muslims and Islam, yes, they're bigoted, they're stupid, and they're inaccurate. At the same time, I wouldn't have a problem in a debate with Sam Harris saying, yes, of course, like, it would be worse to be a woman in Taliban Afghanistan than in Massachusetts. That's an obvious statement. And I'm not going to get into a whole, like, you know, what my cultural conditioning is that makes me say that. There's other parts that we can, you know, there's other areas that are less extreme, which we could have much more subtle conversations about, which are legitimate. But of course, like, that basic question is true. Now you got to get into why and what the context is for it, and how Afghanistan was actually, in some ways, you know, has a history of actually pretty relatively progressive, you know, gender relationships in some respects. And certainly in the 60s and 70s is moving in a very different direction. And, you know, all of the deeper stuff that someone like Harris either doesn't know anything about or just doesn't want to get into, because he's essentially just a, you know, sort of mouthpiece for the comfortable assumptions of a, you know, sort of armchair atheist, you know, foreign policy fools. But you see what I mean? Like, I don't think it's necessary to get caught up in some type of extreme relativistic argument about, you know, a pretty basic truism, which you would get a cosign from like most everybody in the globe across political lines. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I was gonna moving on from the stuff with Peterson, because I don't know, talking about him at this point has given me like a headache. Everyone talks about him. People I meet at the bar will bring him up, and I'll be like, oh,
you gotta get to a better bar. Jesus.
Well, I was gonna get on to, since we were talking about Charles Murray, one of the series you've been doing with the Michael Brooks Show that I really like is Illicit Histories, and you had a Charles Murray episode. But tell us how you started the Illicit History series.
I started it, and they're mostly, it's mostly patron content, although sometimes we unlock things. But I try to weave it actually throughout all of the show. You know, the cold opens for the show are usually like historically oriented clips, and in my opening commentaries, I try to give historical contextualization. I mean, it just seems to me that in almost every single conversation that we're involved in, there is just that is actually always the missing piece. Maybe it's my ballywick. I know there's a certain type of skeptic nerd type that thinks the big problem is that not everybody, you know, believes in science, whatever the hell that even means, frankly. I guess it's a whole other question. I have some sort of epistemic concerns about that viewpoint. But what I so often run into is just the such a foundational lack of a way to contextualize what is happening now across the political spectrum. So, you know, one relatively small example of it, but with big consequences, was, you know, being in the primary in 2016. And, you know, obviously I was a big, you know, Bernie supporter, and looking at this whole sort of like pseudo woke Clinton play for, you know, being the candidate of multiculturalism and so on and so forth. Now, there were many ways to critique the argument they were making in and of themselves while it was happening. But it just was mind-boggling to me that nobody had even, you know, read a handful of books about the Clinton record in the 1990s and how, in fact, the first sort of Clinton, you know, victory, national victory in 1992 was actually the inverse of what Hillary Clinton was doing. It actually had some pretty strong economic populist tendencies inside a, you know, totally democratic capitalist context, but nonetheless, some, you know, relatively strong talk on universal health care and progressive taxation. And it was all about, you know, we're going to bring back the death penalty. You know, we're going to be strong on the death, but not bring it back, but we'll support it unequivocally. Bill Clinton went to Arkansas and executed a mentally incapacitated, you know, black man when he was running for president. The welfare talk, I mean, it very, very racialized, I would say racist, you know, cultural appeals.
Super predators.
That was a couple years later. So I see, you know, and of course I, you know, my God, all of the conversations about Islam and everything else, which again, it's not even just a question of like, oh, this is all the United States' fault. It's not all the United States' fault. It's all everything's fault. How is it that people don't understand, you know, the Shiite revival and Iran, and then how the Saudis reacted with this, you know, just extreme Salafist push, which was bizarrely interpreted as apolitical because it was anti-communist, you know, and funded by the United States, plus a whole bunch of other areas that fascinate me in terms, you know, Jamaican gang warfare in the 70s and the CIA, you know, for what it's worth, looking at somebody like Charles Murray. I did an illicit history with Nathan Robinson on Charles Murray. So I think that, or last week with Bill Fletcher Jr. on global Marxist tradition and Amichel Cabral, or Douglas Lane on Marxist critique of the Gotha program. So I just see so many areas of history, whether they be movements, countries, events, or people, and also like defining ideas, that if people had at least some kind of workable grasp of, I think we would all be navigating things a lot more effectively.
Yeah, I would definitely agree with that. And the two episodes I really enjoyed were the one on Silicon Valley fascism with Corey Pine, and also your episodes that you've done with Christopher Ryan.
Yes. Yep, Christopher Ryan's great. Illicit histories of sex, and also on the Human Zoo, and Corey Pine. That's a perfect example. Going back to, you know, the history of Stanford University and the fact that, you know, there were these creepy quant tech guys with everything from, you know, literal connections to the Nazis through that CIA pipeline, which people know about, which is the more lurid stuff. But even just sort of like early pioneers of tech who were pushing, you know, the IQ story and racism back in the 60s and 70s. And then you can start to realize that, you know, so much of what we see, I mean, I'll be a little bit of a Joseph Campbell. I am a Joseph Campbell defender in some ways. And I think his anti-Semitism and racism, I think, is pretty well established in his, you know, collegial and private life, which is terrible, but his public output was, you know, nowhere near as garbage and a lot more fun and charming than Jordan Peterson's. But that being said, I mean, how are you going to understand Jordan Peterson without understanding Joseph Campbell? You know, how are you going to understand all of these, you know, sort of techno-utopian fusions of hyper-capitalism, tech, and racism without going back, you know, to the 60s and you know, the history of testing and personality models in Silicon Valley? It just, to me, it just seems like a fool's errand. And in every single area, I mean, that's, I'm a very strong critic of Ta-Nehisi Coates in many ways, but I one thing I really am a very staunch defender of his on is the fact that, you know, a piece like his history of housing discrimination and wealth collapse and wealth destruction in the African-American community, like, I have a, you know, a more, I have a different read on it, in some ways different conclusions, because I want to decommodify housing. But my God, I mean, let's be real here. It's, I think if white people read that and actually absorbed that lesson, we would have a much better culture. And, you know, there's just so many people who, you know, their whole, their viewpoint of analysis is either, you know, this sort of narrow quantitative determinism, or, you know, thought experiment fantasies, or, you know, or my God, these, you know, the Peterson magical evolutionary story, and a lot of other just kind of commentators that are just sort of, you know, just basically grinding it out with hot takes from day to day. And, you know, at some point, I think the histories, the context gives you the nutrition to actually metabolize the present. I mean, my God, even fucking Trump. I mean, how can you just take it so narrow? How can you understand Trump if you don't understand the Southern strategy? If you don't understand Reagan announcing his candidacy in a town where four civil rights workers were murdered? I just don't get how you do it.
Right, right. And I think the other thing is that we have to, a lot of our great thinkers are either getting up there in age now or they're passing away. I think I mentioned to you before the show in some exchanges that we had, you know, that I appreciated you having on Adolf Reed and also knowing that you're a fan of Zygmunt Bauman.
Yes. No, I think that that's, I mean, that those are exactly the types of people. And I would certainly add, you know, Bill Fletcher Jr. to this. I mean, I would add, I guess I don't want to say he's not that up there, and hopefully all these people will be with us for much longer, though obviously Zygmunt Bauman passed. But yes, I mean, if you read these people, and in fact, a lot of them are often Marxists, the sweep of cultural history and reference points for understanding how we live and how to contextualize our experiences is just unparalleled. It's also deeply unsettling. I think it's unsettling for people when, you know, Adolf Reed demonstrates that, you know, of course, racism is a thing that flows through and forms American history, but also manifests in radically different ways depending on economic stages and what we're constructing as race. And, you know, That's what I'm wondering with some people is if they resent knowing the context because they want everything in front of them naturalized, and they actually really desire that. There must be a deep comfort in that. And, you know, obviously read Marx, my God, everything from, it's fucking exhausting. Anyways, critiquing Ricardo, he's making obscure historical references and, you know, referencing Frankenstein, and it actually all makes sense. You know, it's and yeah, I mean, it's I guess it's my temperamental bias, but it's also the only way that I can see that we can kind of analytically grasp where we're at without just sort of like restating or reaffirming or reacting to where we're at now.
Right, right. And it's the reason I wanted to mention Bauman is I feel like a lot of people don't know Zygmunt Bauman, which is really unfortunate because I actually been reading his work again lately, And it's interesting. He has a lot of the same concerns as someone like Jordan Peterson. He doesn't really like hookup culture. You know, he's interested in building relationships rather than, you know, simple materialism. But he's like, he doesn't go in this reactionary direction with it. Bauman, for me, is like the antidote to Peterson.
Well, I think you're right. And I think, you know, obviously, I mean, I'm thinking mostly of Liquid Modernity and Wasted Lives. And I think this is actually, yes, Bauman is concerned about the experience of modern life and capitalism as this just, that there's no stability, there's no foundation, there's no solidarity. Everything is just, you know, meshwork and flows, and literally like that imagery of like liquid, right? Like capital should be mobile, people should be mobile, nothing should really stick you to anything at any point. And I think obviously you do. I mean, you know, well, I've had some fun in the hookup culture. But that being said, I mean, of course you can see the parallel between, you know, hookup culture and outsourcing, as an example, or upgrading your phone, in fact. I mean, you know, all of these kind of analogies and experiences we have do parallel each other. And Zygmunt Bauman did a really good job of explaining that. But of course, I mean, yeah, that also shows where, you know, someone like Peterson is so utterly delusional, because, you know, the real threat to all of this stuff is not us supporting transgender rights. It's capitalism. You know, if you really, I mean, the funniest thing about Peterson is that if he was in any way worth his salt, he would be advocating some type of, like, you know, I don't even know, like mid 20th century, like, you know, Catholic sort of gentle socialist project. He would basically come out and say, I am opposed to the two major trends in world politics today, which are, you know, advancements of social rights in gender and categories, at least culturally, right? And I'm also totally opposed to capitalism.
Well, he would almost be more like a Thomas Merton or a Sophie Scholl, you know?
No, he would be. And I mean, I don't know that Thomas, I mean, my understanding of Thomas Merton's politics were that he was actually opposed to Vietnam and supported civil rights and so on. So I kind of hesitate to, you know, link him with a reactionary, but yes, I think, or maybe Wendell Berry, you know, with a sort of like agrarian critique of, or a lot, I mean, you know, Neil Postman even. I mean, what I don't understand, the thing that's so shocking is, why isn't, you know, Jordan Peterson should be obsessed with turning off YouTube, getting away from TVs, getting off the phone, getting out of the office, growing a beard, working the land. I mean, those sorts of tropes would actually sync up. It's part of what makes his marketing so brilliant, is that he appeals to that ethos while basically just telling you to be a respectful, subservient cog in the machine. That's actually his message about capitalism. But yes, in Bauman's case, and I don't think Bauman wasn't, you know, Bauman definitely wasn't a reactionary, and Bauman was a Marxist and not opposed to, you know, lifting oppression on categories of people around their identity. But his concern about the total destruction of bonds and social stability, you know, he laid at the feet of the force that was disrupting all of that. And that's totally unfettered capitalism. And you know, that's, we know this. And I think, yes, Zygmunt Bauman would be the anecdote, but Zygmunt Bauman is difficult to read, and there isn't fun stuff about the double helix and, you know, why girls suck or won't suck you, or, you know, whatever the problem might be.
Well, last thing on, yes, a lighter note.
Yes.
I have to ask, I know you're into hip hop and rap.
Yes.
And I heard you are not a fan of Immortal Technique. What is up with that?
Oh God, man. I don't know. Immortal Technique is just, I guess to be really honest with you, I like rap that's like about killing people and dealing drugs and like having sex with girls. I'm not a huge backpack rap guy. And I don't hate Immortal Technique, but you know, I don't know. He's all right. But he's not like, did you listen to Pusha T's Drake track yet?
No, I haven't. I have to be honest. I'm more of a metalhead. I'm kind of lowbrow in that regard.
Well, fair enough. I'm absolutely to each their own. But I'm just saying, like, that attack, where he simultaneously revealed Drake's illegitimate child, ruined an Adidas product launch, and also, like, I can't even describe it. It's vicious. It's just brutal, brilliant wordplay. And I mean, I think one of the reasons I like Nas is, you know, there is a politics to it. Although there is a politics, by the way, to almost all, certainly like 90s rap, right? Like if you listen to Biggie records, particularly Ready to Die, it's not like political, but politics is all over it. If you want to listen to it that way, you could totally listen to it as, you know, crack through Giuliani era, race, class, upward mobility, and a broader ethos of capitalism, actually. If you want to, it's all there. It's a brilliant album. So I'm not like opposed to it, but I'm not like, I guess I'm not looking for like dorm room enlightenment in my rap records. And Immortal Technique has always sounded a little bit like that to me. Although I did hear that he bullied Manuel Miranda, the guy who made Hamilton. They went to high school together, and Immortal Technique picked on him, so that made me like Immortal Technique a lot more.
I think that may be the best note to end on. I want to thank you again for coming on the show, Michael Brooks.
Oh, it's my absolute pleasure. Talk to you soon. Thanks, man.
I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Michael Brooks. Since we were delving into rap and hip-hop at the end of our conversation, I thought it would be fitting to end this episode with a hip-hop remix of the Goblin track, Suspiria.